I'm Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. So today we have a great group of panelists that I'm excited to introduce you to. They will be discussing today the first annual domestic terrorism conference hosted by NJOHSP in coordination with the Regional Intelligence Academy on Friday, May 6th in New Brunswick. So at this conference, terrorism and intelligence experts from across the Mid-Atlantic region gathered to discuss domestic terrorism on a national and regional scale. Participants at this conference included representatives from the Program on Extremism at George Washington University's Center on Cyber and Homeland Security, the Department of Justice's National Security Division, Maryland University's National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Response to Terrorism, the New York Police Department, West Point's Counterterrorism Center, and Fusion Center representatives from New York and Maryland, just to name a few. So what we thought we'd do here today is to get those involved in planning the inner workings of this conference together to discuss the key takeaways of the conference and what our projected domestic terrorism threat landscape is over the next year. So what I'm going to do is ask them to introduce themselves, and we'll start off with NJOHSP Director of Intelligence, Rosemary Martirana.
Great. Thanks, Allison. And thank you for that introduction. I'm happy to be here today, and hopefully we can have a great conversation.
Hi, my name is Alyssa Potter. I'm an intelligence analyst here at NJOHSP. Happy to participate.
Hi, everyone. Paige Schilling. I thought this conference was great. I have white supremacists and black separatists, so we talked a lot about groups that usually don't get a lot of attention.
And my name is Dean Verrata. I'm the bureau chief here at OHSP, and normally your regular host for these webinars, but Allison has taken over for today, so.
Thanks, Dean. All right, so moving right along, before we get into a lengthy conversation about our domestic terrorism conference, I just want to clarify how you define domestic terrorism and what makes a domestic terrorist distinct from an individual exercising their constitutional rights. So can you kind of get into that a little bit, Dean?
So what we do is we really go by the FBI standards and definitions, and that's really a three-pronged approach when looking at any potential domestic terrorist incident or a person. And so that is, you need to have use of violence or threat of violence against persons or property. It needs to be done in furtherance of a political or social agenda, and it needs to be done to intimidate or coerce a population. When we look at any potential domestic terrorism incident, it needs to check off all three of those boxes. Now, the trick is there is even a lot of gray zone there between groups. So who decides if somebody is being intimidated or coerced? Is that the victim? Is that the perpetrator? In the event somebody dies or doesn't want to talk, how do you know what their real intent is? And so we spend a lot of time sort of wrestling with those cases that are in the gray area.
Great. And again, what would separate a domestic terrorist from somebody who might just be, you know, executing their constitutional rights?
Yeah, so, you know, typically I say, you know, you can have beliefs all day long. So if you're a white supremacist, you can rave about how you think white's the superior race. But at the end of the day, our office becomes involved and interested if you take those beliefs and those threats and you add violence onto it. So it goes from, I believe white to the superior race, to I believe this and I need to hurt minorities in order to accomplish my goals. So there's that threshold. And when it's crossed, that's when it goes from constitutionally protected behavior to potentially criminal or terrorist behavior.
You know, I just want to add one point too, Allison. Oftentimes we get the question of, well, what about these homegrown violent extremists, right? Like, where do they fall? Are they considered domestic terrorist extremists, or are they considered part of, you know, those individuals that might be tracking with ISIS and overseas organizations? And I think it's important to clarify that, you know, these folks in particular, we in the office often put them in that gray space, or they kind of walk a fine line between international terrorist groups and domestic terrorist groups, because they are active here in the United States, yet simply inspired by those overseas organizations and those foreign terrorist organizations. So it's important to kind of keep that in mind when we talk about that homegrown violent threat.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. So now that we kind of have a, you know, understanding as far as, you know, what is domestic terrorism and what is not domestic terrorism, I had a question for you, Rosemary, which is, just 1 month ago, NJOHSP hosted its 10th anniversary annual conference. So why did you decide to have a separate conference totally dedicated to domestic terrorism?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. So the annual conference was mostly centered around the three mission spaces in our office. So counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and resiliency. And when we looked at the counterterrorism topics we wanted to discuss at the annual conference, a lot of it was focused on what we had seen that year, the previous year, and what do we expect to see into the future. And a lot of that attention is taken up by those international terrorist organizations and, you know, unfolding issues occurring overseas. And so we really wanted to dedicate a certain amount of time to the issue of domestic terrorism. So by way of background, the idea for this conference actually stemmed, I don't know, about 9 months ago. Actually, we started to plan this conference. Again, really wanting to make sure we had a common understanding of what our domestic terrorism threat looked like in the United States, so, and in New Jersey for that matter.
Okay, so going through the agenda, you know, I've just been flipping through it. I noticed that the first speaker of the day was Clint Watts, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And he mentioned a story that I remember resonated particularly with me, involving a complex IED that was built by domestic terrorists in Spokane, Washington, and how it kind of flew under the radar last year. So there seemed to be that common theme throughout the day of domestic terrorism not really grabbing the same attention from the media as foreign terrorist groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So why do you all suppose that maybe this would be the case?
I'll jump in. So I think there's a couple reasons. One is, certainly when we're talking about international terrorism, there is, and this is something we might get into later, there's a distinct charge, right? I mean, you can actually charge somebody for supporting an international terrorist organization. And there is no equivalent on the domestic side. So oftentimes a domestic terrorist incident might receive a charge of murder, right, or homicide. And so it's just a little harder to convey that this is terrorism in the same vein. So I think that's part of it. I think there's just also, it's a lot easier for everyone to sort of get their heads around and rally around the idea of sort of an external threat rather than an internal one. Whether you're talking about far left terrorism in the 60s and 70s or far right terrorism in the 90s, particularly in sort of a hot partisan climate like we have now, it can be difficult to talk about some of these issues. Whereas when you talk about a definite outsider group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, everyone can kind of rally behind that they're clearly not part of our tradition, right? And you don't have that gray area as much.
I'll just add on a practical level, sometimes these domestic terror incidents are kind of lost in the fray. And part of that reason is because the motivations may be less clear. You know, we may not determine the motivation until, you know, some time after the incident. So, you know, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they're always claiming responsibility and even for incidents that they're not responsible for. So they make it pretty clear, right, that this is terrorism. A lot of times with domestic terrorism, that conversation needs to happen is, you know, does it check the three boxes that Dean mentioned earlier, that's the FBI's definition? And is this really terrorism?
And also, some of the domestic terrorists are acting alone. They're not acting in groups such as Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So it's not so easy to, you know, determine what they're doing individually as you would if they were in a big group and more noticeable.
And while the news might, you know, portray ISIS as the biggest and most concerning threat, you know, kind of on a nightly basis, I know that all of you have put out an annual threat assessment where you analyze domestic terrorism. What did you find was the actuality with regards to domestic terrorist attacks and plots in the past year?
I mean, in 2015, over half of the attacks that we recorded and that we actually put out on a map were perpetrated by domestic terror groups. So white supremacists, sovereign citizens, militia, extremists, which is kind of a shock to everyday Americans. Because as you said, every time they look on the news, they're bombarded with pictures of ISIS and the threat that's posed by this external group. But really, a lot of Americans don't realize the threat that's posed by groups that do live here in the United States, and some of which call New Jersey home.
I think one sort of addendum to that is that is not saying that sort of groups like ISIS are not a threat, but in some cases, a lot of our counterterrorism efforts have been focused at sort of keeping external people out, right? So it's harder to get in through the airports and we have tighter security, all that stuff in order to get into the country, better tracking of folks like that and working with other governments. With domestic terrorism, some of those procedures aren't going to apply because they're already here and they have free movement. And yeah, that makes it tough. And I know when we did the assessment, that just sort of the numbers of domestic terrorist-inspired attacks versus foreign ones was interesting. And how many of those occurred on the eastern third of the country, which I think was it 60%? From the ones we identified. Yeah, so that was also, you know, a prime mover why we did this.
So throughout the day, we heard about domestic terrorism from analysts and law enforcement in New York, Maryland, and New Jersey. What were some of the common themes we saw among each of these states' perspectives on the domestic terrorism threat landscape in each of their jurisdictions?
So here at OHSP, when we determine the threat that a group poses, it's really a methodology, and it's based upon the presence of that group in the state, their capability, and their intent. So we have a certain ranking system, and we found that moderate threats included white supremacists, sovereign citizens, and militias. And I thought it was surprising that all of the other states that we had come and speak, including Maryland and New York, were naming the same groups. So it's apparent that in these states, they're using maybe a similar methodology, or it's the similar threat landscape. Other groups such as black separatists or animal or eco rights extremists were mentioned less often. So maybe it's not just a New Jersey thing, but maybe it's like a mid-Atlantic that this pushes through. Additionally, often the groups that we were talking about, they seem to be employing the same kind of tactics. So for example, sovereign citizen activity in Maryland mirror what we see here in New Jersey. So the same filing of fraudulent paperwork, filing liens, squatting in houses. And also in relation to white supremacists, we noted disorganization here in New Jersey, and also that was mentioned in New York. So it's really important to understand these similarities, but also understand these differences, right? Because groups here in New Jersey can't be viewed in a vacuum. Things that happen in other states or things that happen in neighboring states may affect groups here. And I think that's what's really important about this domestic terrorism conference, is me as an analyst was able to sit down with analysts in other states, and we were able to hash out the similarities and the differences. And I think we all walked away knowing more about our groups collectively than we did before.
And, you know, now that we've kind of spoken about the regional perspectives that we heard from some of our speakers, what did you all find as some of the major takeaways of this conference across the board from any of our speakers? Was there anything in particular that really resonated with you or stood out?
So one of the things that stood out for me was the potential for violence among these groups. Like, it's okay to protest and do whatever you want that's constitutionally protected, but it's when that line is crossed. And I think that throughout the day, we heard, you know, some of these lines that have been crossed and what is the potential for that. So while we're not actively looking for these, you have to be aware that some of these groups or a person in that group could potentially, you know, do some harm to somebody. They don't like what's going on and become more radical themselves and then break away from the group.
There were a couple things that really sort of struck me, some interesting new ways to sort of view the issue. But one was the Department of Justice. We had a representative from the new office that's focusing on domestic terrorism. And I guess we knew this, but he put it in a really interesting way, where he was talking about how we have a definition, a legal definition of what domestic terrorism is, but there's no underlying statute to prosecute anyone under it. And certainly I know there's been some interesting conversations online over the past couple months about, should we have a domestic terrorism charge like we do for international terrorists, or would that cause more harm than good? So it was very interesting to sort of hear that point explicitly made. And someone in the audience raised an interesting topic that I think is worthy of thinking about some more, where he's recommended that, gee, maybe when we're talking about domestic and international terrorism, maybe if we look at a division of labor where the FBI is looking at sort of international terrorist groups, and maybe the role for state and locals is to look at domestic terrorist groups, since there is no distinct federal charge. And I think that would need to be hashed out and really talked about. But I thought it was an interesting concept when that person brought it up. It was very worthwhile.
Yeah, I think it was great to see the audience thinking in that direction. And it raised a good issue, which I don't think any of us have an answer for right now. But that division of labor, I think, in the future is going to be really important on how not only we analyze these groups, but how we effectively prosecute these individuals.
And I think I'll just end it off by talking a bit about nationwide speakers like J.M. Berger and J.J. McNabb compared to the local speakers. So I know for me as an analyst, sometimes it's really easy to get caught up in being so New Jersey-centric. Like, what are my groups doing here? And you don't forget about what's happening nationwide, but it's always important to take that into account when you do your analysis. So I know that J.M. Berger did a really interesting presentation on white supremacist social media activity. And then J.J. McNabb did a really interesting look at the Oregon standoff and the Bundy standoff and how this kind of relates nationwide. And I know that I came away, at least as an analyst, thinking, okay, these are completely different ways to think about, you know, my groups here in New Jersey.
And did you find anything, you know, kind of going off that with militia groups, did you find anything else interesting pertaining to anti-government groups in general? I know that she had some breakdown as far as looking at anti-government groups as far as, you know, being their own kind of government. I know, Dean, you've kind of discussed this before.
Yeah, so this was an interesting way to look at it. When you look at groups like Sovereign Citizens or a lot of the militia groups who either think the government is illegitimate or has, you know, so overstretched its bounds that it doesn't deserve to rule, whatever. An interesting way to look at it is to break the anti-government movement into some components and think about the functions they serve. So, for example, the militia movement, think about them as a Department of Defense. The Sovereign Citizens, think about them as the judiciary branch. Mm-hmm. And there was another group in comparison that escaped me right now. But
it's like militia groups in the DOD, I think, was the comparison.
That was the, it was the first one, the Sovereigns and Judiciary. But I think there was another one as well. And I hadn't really thought about them like that before. But
it
kind of makes sense, especially given how in the wake of sort of the Oregon standoff, you've seen these folks sort of working together. Not totally coordinated, but each trying to help each other.
Paige, you kind of touched on J.M. Berger talking about, you know, domestic terrorist use of social media. I know that he compared domestic terrorist groups to ISIS's use of Twitter as propaganda and recruitment tool, saying that ISIS is not the first or the last to exploit this tool, and probably not even the most effective over time. So what resonated most with you about his findings, and how else have we seen other domestic terrorist groups using social media?
I think that one of the points he made was recruiting and mobilizing like-minded individuals is very easy now because of Twitter, Facebook, and other social media. So it's as easy as having one social media account and getting those followers, you know, and being able to network with those individuals. But I thought what was interesting that he said was that white supremacists and those types of groups are actually better at using Twitter because they don't get suspended as often. We know ISIS gets suspended constantly because they're very outward about what they're doing. And white supremacists, although they might have something in their biographies on Twitter or Facebook, they're not eliciting the, you know, they're not raising the red flags as much. So one of the things JM said was that these networks are getting crushed because they have to keep signing up for new accounts and then they're losing all their followers. So that kind of loses momentum for them. So I thought that that was really interesting.
And I just have to say, I'm a big fangirl of JM Berger and I love his work. And I thought it was really interesting what he did with white supremacists. And, you know, he talked about the different roles on social media. So, you know, am I a person who just goes on and retweets some things that people say? Or am I the person that's leading? Am I the person who's being retweeted? And how, you know, this kind of reflects on the organization altogether. And he also talked about how hashtags resonated with this group. So he was talking particularly about white genocide or black on white crime or, you know, matters related to the election, and how white supremacists were really grabbing onto these hashtags. And that was really breathing life into their movements online.
So just touching on the hashtag comment, though, and you cover white supremacist page, so I'm actually interested in hearing your opinion on this. Like, do you see those groups actually kind of doing some of the hashtag hijacking techniques that we've seen ISIS and those international terrorist groups doing as well?
You know, I can't say that I have seen them hijack. I've seen them make fun of certain hashtags or, you know, change them or manipulate them. But I think a lot of the times, you know, when they talk especially about the white genocide, that's something they believe really strongly in. And I think, you know, it's a reflection of the white supremacist community that exists today. And that's just really resonating with them. And they're really pushing that forward. And, you know, JM said he expects that this type of activity will pick up, you know, later in the year as we get closer to the election.
The other thing I thought was fascinating was the discussion about sort of international trolls in fermenting domestic extremism. And so specifically, you talked about the role of sort of Russian trolls in sort of really getting the ball rolling when it comes to sort of white nationalist, white supremacist activity online. And I think that fits in if you look at sort of what Russia has done sort of internationally over the past couple of years. It makes sense as soon as you hear it, but it's not something you would think about initially. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was very interesting.
One of the main points that we heard from the Council for Domestic Terrorism Matters at the U.S. Department of Justice was that domestic terrorism investigations and prosecutions can be challenging from, as we mentioned before, defining domestic terrorism all the way to determining how to charge individuals. So what do you all see as some of the major challenges you face with regard to, and I'll address this one to the analyst, not only analyzing domestic terrorism, but also maybe Rosemary from a policy perspective to preventing it?
I would say that when we're looking at international versus domestic terrorism does pose certain challenges to the analysts. And this is kind of roped in, I think, with the media attention question you asked earlier. So sometimes these incidents can be harder to find in general because, you know, they happened in a small town in the Midwest and no one's really talking about it. Secondly, it can be more difficult to investigate because the motivation's not clear and we may not know it for a few months afterwards. And third, it's not broadcast the same way international terrorism is. So domestic terrorism does take a different approach from the analysts. It requires at times a deeper dive into literature to pull it out. Would you agree with that, Alyssa?
Yes, I would. The groups that I specifically look at, so are eco and animal rights. And one of the challenges with that is that they are all following a leaderless resistance model. So if something happens, they can claim it on behalf of the animal liberation organization or an eco-extremist group without being a physical member of that group. So some of these cases we don't hear about for a couple of years. This past July, we heard about a case that I had looked at in 2013, why there was this huge spike in animal rights incidents. Well, we found out last July that there was two individuals that went on a cross-country road trip freeing minks from various farms across the United States. So it always makes sense, but sometimes it's going to take maybe even a year to figure out why there is a spike or a decrease in something.
And I'm just going to chime in. I know that I'm actually moderating this, but as an intelligence analyst, one of the groups that I actually analyze are sovereign citizens. And I can tell you that one of the challenges that I face when analyzing incidents where sovereign citizens are involved in violence is there are many times, and this kind of goes back to HVEs kind of have a similar trend, which is an individual will commit a violent act or a crime, let's say, and then afterwards will say, doesn't matter, you can't charge me, I'm a sovereign citizen, the laws don't apply to me. And you have to sometimes decipher, does that individual actually subscribe to the ideology, or are they just kind of being opportunistic in saying that they're a sovereign citizen after the fact to get away with the crime? So I think many times you have to make that determination as well afterwards when you're kind of going through the press releases and the story is developing.
I would say one of the biggest challenges we face too is almost just the word terrorism. So there'll be incidents that occur, some of them horrendous, and sort of the public reaction, sometimes the media reaction is, how can this not be called terrorism? And again, this is where we go back, you know, we retreat to our 3-point definition, and that's not always satisfactory. It's just not satisfactory for the general public or the media to hear us reply and go, well, you know, it doesn't fit our 3 points. I'm sorry. We have to call this something else. The word itself is sort of so charged and has so much sort of emotional resonance that sometimes that gets in the way of some of the incidents that we want to or don't want to analyze.
Another theme that we heard throughout the day was that different domestic terrorist groups seem to be influencing each other. So we heard Clint Watts say that it's important for us to look at how extremist groups learn and adopt from each other. And in the same vein, one of the central themes from the 2016 NJOHSP Annual Terrorism Threat Assessment was the concept of being a blended extremist, or individuals who are inspired by a variety of ideologies. How do we see domestic terrorist groups influencing one another, and how should analysts be approaching this trend?
I think first and foremost, domestic terrorism, we already talked about the challenges it poses when analyzing it. But a lot of times the ideologies of these terrorists don't fit in like nice, neat, tidy boxes. So they all just don't have sovereign beliefs or black separatist beliefs. Sometimes we see emerge in those beliefs. And as an analyst, you have to be flexible to identify different characteristics and different ideologies and understand that domestic terrorists sometimes don't play by what we think are, you know, the rules. They pick and they choose what they want to believe in. So Zale Thompson in 2014, I'm sure some of you remember this, he attacked NYPD officers with a hatchet. And he was described as someone who, you know, was anti-law enforcement. He had some jihadist ideology. He was online looking at propaganda from ISIS. But at the same time, he attended new Black Panther Party meetings. So he had some Black separatist influence as well. So he was just kind of a mix of a bunch of things. So as analysts, you need to be able to look at, you know, these individuals and understand that they're picking and choosing from different ideologies.
And I think we also saw that in Oregon as well with the standoff that took place earlier this year. And Allison, I know you've touched on this in several assessments. And again, we all know you're moderating, but I mean, maybe you want to touch on what you saw with the Oregon standoff and some of the domestic terrorist groups that were influencing each other there.
Yeah. So while initially we technically classified the individuals who led off the Oregon standoff as being militia members, there actually were individuals who came, you know, to support this cause who were actually members of a variety of different domestic terrorist groups. We know that white supremacists actually traveled to assist in the standoff. And additionally, we know that a national organization called the National Liberty Alliance, which actually claims to have membership here in New Jersey, encouraged individuals to create what they call a common law grand jury, which has the ability to, in their minds, to issue indictments and ultimately arrest public officials. And they wanted to do that actually in Oregon with some of the individuals involved in the standoff. So we actually saw militia members adopting tactics that are generally used by sovereign citizens. So again, you know, this blended extremist notion of adopting multiple ideologies to carry out your violent actions kind of came into play.
And I think one of the reasons for all this is it's easier to sort of develop your own ideology now, taking little bits and pieces from everywhere, and then you can validate yourself, basically. And so we saw that with Dylann Roof in his long manifesto. He clearly did not have a deep understanding of white supremacist ideology. And we hear the same thing with a lot of the Islamic-inspired homegrown violent extremists, where, you know, the cliche is they're buying Islam for Dummy books before they head to Syria. But same thing is a lot of these folks, they're getting bits and pieces, they're mashing together what they like and discarding what they don't, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of effort or respect for sort of the foundations of those ideologies, and they're kind of doing it on their own.
I guess I kind of skipped over you before, Rosemary, when I was asking about some of the major challenges that we address with not only analyzing domestic terrorism, but also from a policy perspective, as far as what can, you know, we do to prevent it.
Yeah, and that's a difficult topic, of course, whether you're talking about domestic terrorism issues or international terrorism issues, because, you know, as Paige highlighted, the motivations are all often unclear. And so in that sense, it's difficult for us to kind of understand these individuals and also, I don't want to say find, but, you know, basically, you know, to find these individuals before an incident occurs. So it makes prevention a little more difficult. But, you know, back to the point that the Council for Domestic Terrorism Matters, Tom mentioned, was that there might be a greater role for state and local law enforcement officials in this space, especially, you know, if we talk about, you know, a divide and conquer kind of perspective where the federal government looks at some of these threats emanating from overseas and states and locals understand a little more and focus on what's happening within their borders or jurisdictions for that matter.
Great. So I guess this is a great time to move on to, you know, some takeaways from this conference. How do you, Dean and Rosemary, think this conference helped build cooperation and intelligence sharing between federal, state, and local partners? And do you think that the insights gleaned from this conference assisted in investigations and analysis of these groups?
It's a little early to say if it's like led to improvements in investigations or anything like that, but there were a couple of things we wanted to do. We really wanted to get a regional perspective and get people talking across traditional jurisdictions, right? When you're in a state agency, you tend to just look at your state and look at what's going on there. So we wanted to break down those barriers. And I think we took a good step in that direction. We also wanted to get people thinking about these groups in slightly different ways or more systematic ways. And so we put out a number of products to go with that. So for me, I think the test will be next year if we can sort of do this again and get people talking. But more importantly than that, it'll be if this is more than just a one time a year thing. And if people start making phone calls and exchanging emails and doing in-person exchanges to talk about these in sort of on a larger scale.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I'm hoping that this conference was, you know, the first of many. And hopefully one day we'll be able to call this the annual domestic terrorism conference, just like we do with our annual OHSP conference. But if nothing else, you know, I think this year really showed us that there are a lot of federal, state, and local agencies interested in this topic. There's more people that want to talk about it. And so hopefully moving forward, those little business cards were exchanged and people made some connections that in the future, we can continue to share information on an ad hoc or on a regular basis as needed.
Great. So now that we've kind of given you the broad strokes of the conference, we do have some questions. Was there any discussion of the threats to cyber systems and or connected infrastructure in the domestic terror space?
Huh. Threats to cyber systems and infrastructure in the domestic terrorism space. The focus wasn't specifically on threats to the cyber systems. Not to say that we're not seeing that, but that wasn't really the focus of this particular conference. But that raises a good issue that we should be discussing, quite frankly. And I'm not sure I really have the right answer for that question. I don't know if you guys want to weigh in on this one.
So we did not. I mean, the extent of our discussion on cyber was really how domestic groups are leveraging that to get their message out and right. to coordinate their activities. There were a couple brief questions about criminal activity, but in terms of sort of are there domestic extremists using the internet in order to sort of conduct their extremist activity, not as much. And that is a whole nother realm to talk of, because certainly, I mean, I think if you've just been watching the news over the past couple of years and the extent of the damage that trolls can do when they are mobilized in large enough armies, that may be another venue for them to try to move into.
Was anything discussed with the private-public sector relationship in preventing domestic terrorism?
So I would say again that, you know, the highlight of this conference was analysis and how intelligence analysts, you know, will share and communicate different trends that they see. So this wasn't talked about specifically, but I know at OHSP, we put a lot of emphasis on strengthening our relationships with our private partners. We have private sector working groups for each of our sectors, and we encourage them to report suspicious activity, and we really make an effort to reach out to certain communities. So specifically for the Planned Parenthood community, we saw that there was a gap that we could fill for them and kind of reach out and see if there were any extremists targeting different sectors or different Planned Parenthood facilities or medical facilities in New Jersey. So we're always looking to get suggestions of where we need to make up and where we can really connect with our private sector partners.
I just asked a question about discussion about anarchist activity during the summer political conventions. As you can imagine, the current political climate is sort of at the forefront of a lot of people's minds. All the speakers, I think, independently, It was there, but we did not want to focus on it explicitly. When it comes to anarchist activity, I think there have been anarchist extremists present at most of the political conventions over the past few cycles, so I would be surprised if nobody showed up at any of them, but we did not discuss them specifically surrounding these conventions.
Just to piggyback off what Dean said, if you took a look at our annual threat assessment, we consider anarchist extremists in New Jersey to be low threat. And actually, anarchist extremists were involved back in 2011 in the protests against the National Socialist Movement Convention, which actually ultimately sent two individuals to the hospital. But that's really the most recent violent activity that we've seen anarchist extremists involved in to date in the state. Has social media been as valuable a tool for investigation and analysis as it seems to have been for extremist groups? Where does this issue fall in the balance? So would one of you like to take on this one?
I think it's been valuable. I don't know if I could weigh which has been, you know, more valuable for whom. But certainly if you review, for example, the criminal complaints of the dozens of homegrown violent extremists who have been arrested since 2010, they are littered with anecdotes of these extremists who go online on some form of social media usually and say something, do something, incriminate themselves that leads to them getting charged. So it does help, but certainly extremist groups are finding it valuable as well. So I don't know if I'd say who's winning that one, but we'd certainly like them to win less in that one.
I can say as an analyst that, you know, I'm on TweetDeck most of my day, and I'm looking at different hashtags.
TweetDeck, Paige?
TweetDeck, for those of you who don't know, is this nifty little app that allows you to look at columns. So you can search maybe a hashtag and make that a column. So you're not following people per se, but every time someone uses that hashtag, it'll pop up. Or, for example, you know, I do Black Separatists, so I have hashtag New Black Panther Party. So anytime anyone uses that hashtag, I can see and I can review the tweets that come up. So for those of you who don't have Twitter, it is an amazing tool. The news may not always be 100% accurate because it's coming out so quickly, but it's a way to really connect with different academics and to follow and to kind of, you know, watch for these hashtags so you can view the movements overall.
In fact, a number of the speakers that we hosted at our conference actually have very active Twitter accounts with very up-to-date information about a variety of domestic terrorist groups. So definitely serves as a tool for us as analysts.
One last thing before we go. We just put out on our website a bundle of products related to the Oregon standoff. You can find them at njohsp.gov. They should be on the front page or in the publications page. I think there's 4 or 5 products related to that.
And Dean had mentioned earlier, we do have each of the domestic terrorism snapshots that we had released at the conference. They're all for your public viewing. We take pride in the fact that we try to disseminate information in an unclassified manner such that you're fully informed. And if there are any intelligence gaps that you see in those products that you think you might know the answer to, we highly encourage you to reach out to us so that you can help us answer those questions and we can all work together to have a more complete picture of the domestic terrorism landscape nationwide. And however you choose to get our products, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, or just going to our website, www.njohsp.gov, all serve as tremendous resources on Homeland Security threat-related information. And then with that, thank you all.
Enjoy, and we would very much like to hear your feedback. So thank you very much. Have a good day.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.